Good morning. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. This morning I'll be reading from Helen MacDonald's wonderful book of essays called Vesper Flights, published by Grove Press in 2020. This is a season of spring migration, and this is a wonderful essay called High Rise about her experience in Midtown Manhattan at the top of the Empire State Building, watching birds at night. Dusk is falling over Midtown Manhattan on this chilly evening in early May. I've been Googling the weather forecast all day and pull out my phone to check it once again as I walk down Fifth Avenue. North, northeasterly winds and clear skies. Good. At the Empire State Building, the line snakes around the block, and because I'm the only person in it wearing a pair of binoculars around my neck, I feel a little self-conscious. I inch forward for the next hour, up escalators, through marble halls, past walls of soft gold wallpaper, before squeezing into a crowded elevator and emerging on the 86th floor. At over 1,000 feet above the city, there's a strong breeze and a spectacular sea of light spilling far below. Behind the tourists pressed against the perimeter fence, there's a man leaning back against the wall. Above him, the stars and stripes flap languidly in the night air. I can't see his face in the gloom, but I know this is the man I've come to meet because he's holding a pair of binoculars that look far better than mine, and his face is upturned to the sky. There's an urgency to the way he stands that reminds me of people I've seen at skeet shoots waiting for the trap to fire the next target. He's tense with anticipation. This is Andrew Farnsworth, a soft-spoken researcher at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, and I'm joining him here in hope of seeing a wildlife phenomenon that twice a year sweeps almost unseen above the city, the seasonal night flights of migrating birds. It's an absurdly incongruous place for a nature-viewing expedition. Apart from the familiar exceptions, pigeons, rats, mice, sparrows, we tend to think of wild creatures as living far from the city's margins, and nature is the city's polar opposite. It's easy to see why. The only natural things visible from this height are a faint scatter of stars above and the livid bruise of the Hudson running through the clutter of lights below. Everything else is us. The flash of aircraft, the tilt of bright smartphones, the illuminating grids of windows and streets. Skyscrapers are at their most perfect at night, full-fledged dreams of modernity that erase nature and replace it with a new landscape wrought of artifice, a cartography of steel and glass and light. But people live in them for the same reason that they travel to wild places, to escape the city. The highest buildings raise you above the mess and chaos of life at street level. They also raise you into something else. The sky may seem like an empty place, just as we once thought the deep ocean to be a lifeless void. But like the ocean, this is a vast habitat full of life. Bats and birds, flying insects, spiders, wind-blown seeds, microbes, drifting spores. The more I stare at the city across miles of dusty, uplit air, the more I begin to think of these super tall buildings as machines that work like deep sea submersibles, transporting us to inaccessible realms we cannot otherwise explore. Inside them, the air is calm and clean and temperate. Outside is a tumultuous world teeming with unexpected biological abundance, and we're standing in its midst. Above us, LED bulbs around the base of the spire cast a soft halo of pale light up into the darkness. An incandescent blur of white skips across it. Through binoculars, it resolves into a noctuid moth, wings flapping as it climbs vertically towards the tower. No one fully understands how moths like these orient themselves while migrating. There's speculation that they might navigate by sensing Earth's magnetic fields. This one is flying upward in search of the right airflow that will allow it to travel where it wants to go. Wind-borne migration is an arthropod specialty, allowing creatures like aphids, wasps, lacewings, beetles, moths, and tiny spiders hoisted on strands of electrostatically charged silk to travel distances ranging from tens to hundreds of miles. These drifting creatures are colonizers, pioneers, looking for new places to live, and they'll make a home wherever they find one. Place a rosebush out on the arid environment of a top-floor balcony, and soon wind-borne, sap-sucking aphids will cluster on its stems, followed by the tiny wasps that parasitize them. Insects travel above us in extraordinary numbers. In Britain, the research scientist Jason Chapman uses radar systems aimed into the atmosphere to study their high-altitude movements. Over 7.5 billion can pass over a square mile of English farmland in a single month, about 5,500 pounds of biomass. Chapman thinks the number passing over New York City may even be higher because this is a gateway to a continent, not a small island surrounded by cold seas, and summers here are generally hotter. Once you get above 650 feet, he says, you're lofted into a realm where the distinction between city and countryside has little or no meaning at all. During the day, chimney swifts feast on these vast drifts of life. During the night, so do the city's resident and migrating bats and nighthawks with white-flagged wings. On days with northwest winds, in late summer and early fall, birds, bats, and migrant dragonflies all feed on rich concentrations of insects caused by powerful downdrafts and eddies around the city's high-rise buildings, just as fish swarm to feed where currents congregate plankton in the ocean. It's not just insects up there. The tallest buildings, like the Empire State, One World Trade Center, and other new super towers, project into airspace that birds have used for millennia. The city lies on the Atlantic Flyway, the route used by hundreds of millions of birds to fly north every spring to their breeding grounds and back again in the fall. Most small songbirds tend to travel between 3,000 and 4,000 feet from the ground, but they vary their altitude depending on the weather. Larger birds fly higher, and some, like shorebirds, may well pass over the city at 10,000 to 12,000 feet. Up here, we'll be able to see only a fraction of what is moving past us. Even the tallest buildings dip into only the shallows of the sky. Though you can see migrating raptors soaring at altitudes well over 800 feet above the city during the day, most species of diurnal birds migrate after nightfall. It's safer. Temperatures are cooler, and there are fewer predators around. Fewer, not none. Just before I arrived, Farnsworth saw a peregrine falcon drifting ominously around the building. Peregrines frequently hunt at night here. From high-rise lookout perches, they launch flights into the darkness to grab birds and bats. In more natural habitats, falcons cache the bodies of birds they've killed among crevices on cliffs. The ones here tuck their kills into ledges on high-rises, including the Empire State. For a falcon, a skyscraper is simply a cliff. It brings the same prospects, the same high winds, the same opportunities to stash a takeout meal. We stare out into the dark, willing life into view. Minutes pass. Farnsworth points, there, he says. High above us is a suspicion of movement, right at the edge of vision where the sky dissolves into dusty chaos. I swing my binoculars up to my eyes. Three pale pairs of beating wings flying north-northeast in close formation. Black-crowned night herons. I've only ever seen them hunched on branches or crouched low by lakes and ponds, and it's astounding to see them rent so far from their familiar context. I wonder how high they are. Those are pretty large, Farnsworth says. When you look up into the light, everything looks bigger than it is and closer than it is. He estimates that the herons are about 300 feet above us. So they're about 1,500 feet from ground level. We watch them vanish into the darkness. I feel less like a naturalist here and more like an amateur astronomer waiting for a meteor shower, squinting expectantly into the darkness. I try a new tactic, focusing my binoculars on infinity and pointing them straight upwards. Through the lenses, the birds visible to the naked eye swim into view, and there are birds above them, and birds higher still. It strikes me that we are seeing a lot of birds, an awful lot of birds. For every larger bird I see, 30 or more songbirds pass over. They're very small. Watching their passage is almost too moving to bear. They resemble stars, embers, slow tracer fire. Even through binoculars, those at higher altitudes are tiny, ghostly points of light. I know that they have loose, clenched toes tucked into their chest, bright eyes, thin bones, and a will to fly north that pulls them onward night after night. Most of them spent yesterday in central or southern New Jersey before ascending into darkness. Larger birds keep flying until dawn. The warblers tend to come earlier to earth, dropping like stones into patches of habitat further north to rest and feed over the following day. Some, like yellow rump warblers, began their long journeys in the southeastern states. Others, like rose-breasted grosbeaks, have made their way up from Central America. Something tugs at my heart. I'll never see any of these birds again. If I weren't this high and the birds weren't briefly illuminated by this column of light cast by a building thrown up through the Depression years to celebrate earthly power and capital confidence, I'd never have seen them at all. Farnsworth pulls out a smartphone. Unlike everyone else holding screens up here, he's looking at radar images from Fort Dix in New Jersey, part of a National Weather Service radar network that provides near-continuous coverage of airspace over the continental USA. "It's definitely a heavy migration night tonight," he says. "When you see those kinds of patterns on radar, in particular those greens," he explains, "you're talking about 1,000 to 2,000 birds per cubic mile, potentially, which is almost as dense as it gets, so that's a big night." After days of bad weather for birds wanting to fly north with low cloud and winds in the wrong direction, a bottleneck of migrants built up, and now the sky is full of them. I watched the pixelation blossom on the animated radar map, a blue and green dendritic flower billowing out over the whole East Coast. "This is biological stuff that's up in the atmosphere," Farnsworth says, pointing one finger to the screen. "It's all biology." Meteorologists have long known that you can detect animal life by radar. Just after the Second World War, British radar scientists and Royal Air Force technicians puzzled over mysterious plots and patterns that appeared on their screens. They knew they weren't aircraft and christened them angels before finally concluding that they were flocks of moving birds. "That was their contamination, right?" Farnsworth says, a radar meteorologist. "They wanted to filter all that stuff out. Now the biologists want to do the reverse." Farnsworth is one pioneer of a new multidisciplinary science, fit for an era in which weather radar has become so sensitive it can detect a single bumblebee over 30 miles away. It's called aeroecology, and it uses sophisticated remote sensing technologies like radar, acoustics, and tracking devices to study ecological patterns and relationships in the skies. The whole notion of the aerosphere and airspace as habitat is not something that has come up into the collective psyche until recently, Farnsworth says. And this new science is helping us understand how climate change, skyscrapers, wind turbines, light pollution, and aviation affect the creatures that move above us. At 10 o'clock, cirrus clouds slide overhead like oil poured on water. 10 minutes later, the sky is clear again and the birds are still flying. We move to the east side of the observation deck. A saxophonist begins to play, and in concert with this unlikely soundtrack, we begin to see birds far closer than before. One in particular, though it is overexposed in the light, we detect a smear of black at its chest and a distinctive pattern on its tail, a male yellow-rumped warbler. It flickers past and disappears around the corner of the building. A little while later, we see another flying the same way, then another. It dawns on us that this is the same bird circling. Another one joins it, both now drawn helplessly towards and around the light, reeling about the spire as if caught on invisible strings. Watching them dampens our exuberant mood. The spire is lit with pulsing rivulets of climbing color like a candle tonight to mark the building's 85th anniversary, and these birds have been attracted to it, pulled off course, their exquisite navigational machinery overwhelmed by light, leaving them confused and in considerable danger. After being mesmerized in this way, some birds drag themselves free and continue their journey. Others don't. New York is among the brightest cities in the world after Las Vegas, only one node in a flood of artificial illumination that runs from Boston down to Washington. We cherish our cities for their appearance at night, but it takes a terrible toll on migrating songbirds. You can find them dead or exhausted at the foot of high-rise buildings all over America. Disoriented by light and reflections on glass, they crash into obstacles, fly into windows, spiral down to the ground. More than 100,000 die each year in New York City alone. Thomas King of the New York pest control company M&M Environmental has had calls from residents of high-rise buildings asking him to deal with the birds colliding with their windows during migration season. He tells them that there's no solution, but they can talk to their building manager about turning off the lights. It helps. Programs like New York City Audubon's Lights Out New York have encouraged many high-rise owners to do the same, saving both energy and avian lives. Every year, the Tribute in Light shines twin blue beams into the Manhattan night as a memorial to the lives lost on September 11th. They rise 4 miles into the air and are visible 60 miles from the city. On peak migration nights, songbirds spiral down towards them, calling, pulled from the sky, so many circling in the light they look like glittering, whirling specks of paper caught in the wind. On one night last year, so many were caught in the beams that the few pixels representing the tribute site glowed super bright on the radar maps. Farnsworth was there with the Audubon team that got the lights shut off intermittently to prevent casualties. They switched off the tribute 8 times that night for about 20 minutes at a time, releasing the trapped birds to return to their journey. Each time the lights went back on, a new sweep of birds was drawn in. The Twin Towers made ghosts of light visited over and over by winged travelers intermittently freed into darkness before a crowd rushed in to take their place. Farnsworth is a lead scientist in BirdCast, a project that combines a variety of methods, weather data, flight calls, radar, observers on the ground, to predict the movements of migrating birds throughout the continental United States and forecast big nights like this that might require emergency lights-out action. The flow of birds over the observation deck continues, but it's getting late. I make my farewell, take the elevator back down the building, and wander uphill to my apartment. Though it's long past midnight, I'm wide awake. Part of what high-rise buildings are designed to do is change the way we see, to bring us different views of the world, views intimately linked with prospect and power, to make the invisible visible. The birds I saw were mostly unidentifiable streaks of light, like thin retinal scratches or splashes of luminous paint on a dark background. As I look up from street level, the blank sky above seems a very different place, deep and coursing with life. 2 days later, I decide to walk in Central Park and find it full of newer migrants that arrived here at night and stayed to rest and feed. A black and white warbler tacking along a slanted tree trunk deep in the ramble, a yellow-rumped warbler sallying forth into the bright spring air to grab flies, a black-throated blue warbler, so neat and spry he looks like a folded pocket handkerchief, These songbirds are familiar creatures with familiar meanings. It's hard to reconcile them with the remote lights I witnessed in the sky. Living in a high-rise building bars you from certain ways of interacting with the natural world. You can't put out feeders to watch robins and chickadees in your garden, but you are set in another part of their habitual world, a nocturne of ice crystals and cloud and wind and darkness. High-rise buildings, symbols of mastery over nature, can work as bridges towards a more complete understanding of the natural world, stitching the sky to the ground, nature to the city. For days afterwards, my dreams are full of songbirds, the familiar ones from woods and backyards, but also points of moving light, little astronauts, travelers using the stars to navigate, having fallen to Earth for a little while before picking themselves up and moving on. And that's the chapter called High Rise from Helen MacDonald's book, Vesper Flights. This is Maggie Jones. Thank you for listening.